Fargo is a dog and pony show, a trick film intended to make a metafictional point by exploiting the film's viewers' presupposed moral vacuousness and lurid fascination with sex and violence.
That was a lot of words.
In the actual...
It's not a film of substance, and the point is that truly, in the sense which the Coen brothers mean it, only insubstantial, half-realized characters could be fans of it naturally. To realize this point is to be realized, though, and no longer be a fan.
This person must be really fun at parties.
Oh, man.
Look at it this way. Fargo is brilliant, but still only the most menial, kick them when they're down sense of the word.
Wait, so it's still brilliant, but one star? What?
That was a one-star review from IMDb. Hello and welcome to Spoilers Intended, a podcast about series and films. I'm Ryan, joined as always by Andrew.
Oh yeah, hello there.
And Steven.
Oh geez, I'm so sorry. I just took your intro.
And in this episode, dagnabbit, if we're not reviewing the gosh darned seven-time Academy Award nominated 1996 film from the Coen brothers, Fargo.
It doesn't even take place in Fargo.
Oh yeah.
Just a little bit, just a smidge.
Brainerd.
Like as a treat. 2 minutes.
As a treat.
Yeah. All right, so real quick, gut reactions. What did you guys think, Steven?
I mean, I liked it. I thought it was a good film. I don't know that I'm in a rush to rewatch it anytime soon. This is not quite Grave of the Fireflies territory, where it's like once in your life. Yeah. it's not. I'm not going to watch it, you know, next year. It's going to be a little while.
Right. Andrew?
Pretty much the same. I actually thought this was really, like, this was just a very good film. But if I'm going to watch a Coen Brothers movie, mm-hmm. I'm not going to pick this one.
There are other,
right. there are ones like Burn After Reading, catalog. Big Lebowski, Brother Art Thou.
Yeah.
Brother Art Thou is also a great film.
Yeah.
So I love this movie, and it has a special place for me. I will agree that I think there are better Coen Brothers movies after it, because they've come a long way.
Well, I don't even need to say better. I would say entertaining.
More entertaining, because this one, for me, when it came out, was so unlike anything I had seen before.
And especially for, honestly, how short the film is, it feels very slow-paced.
It is.
It is, but it's to me, it's a deliberate slow pace.
I mean, deliberate, but it's
very
like
Midwestern.
It's so Midwestern. But from like an entertainment perspective, it doesn't move along, if that makes sense.
No, it's not a action-packed. Like every other scene is something crazy going on.
Because the fun part is like you'll be watching these scenes, and you're like, all right, where is this going? Like, what are we doing here?
Right.
And then, they get to the point, you're like, ha ha, that was good.
Yeah, the punchline lands, and you're like, oh.
It all pays off. It does. Yeah. Okay, so let's get into a plot summary. We got it. Minnesota car salesman Jerry Lundegaard's inept crime falls apart due to his and his henchmen's bungling and the persistent police work of the quite pregnant Marge Gunderson.
Quite pregnant.
What a descriptor.
I know. All right, this was released March 8th, 1996, written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, who you probably know from The True Grit, the remake, No Country for Old Men, Raising Arizona, The Big Lebowski, Burn After Reading, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and many, many, many more.
Yep.
Music by Carter Burwell, who did some recent stuff like The True Grit remake with them. He did a couple other Coen Brothers movies. He did The Banshees of Inisherin and Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri.
Banshees of Inisherin was up for Best Picture last year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I knew the name, but I have not seen it.
Colin Farrell and Brian Gleason, I believe.
Sounds good. Yeah, why not? I don't know.
I wanted to see it really bad. It looks like a really good movie. Starring Frances McDormand, William H. Macy, Steve Buscemi, and Peter Stormare, and a bunch of other assisting characters, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Box office was $24.6 million on a budget of $7
million. So, good return.
Yeah,
they made bank back, honestly.
Yeah.
Imagine it was probably a small crew. They didn't have a ton of actors, necessarily.
And this is very much so kind of like a borderline art house film that was, I don't want to call it awards bait, because it doesn't feel like a film made for awards bait, but it got a lot of nominations.
This movie feels like a movie that they just wanted to make.
Yeah.
They had this story, and they're like, we got to tell it.
Just fun. Yeah.
All right. Overall thoughts. Who wants to start off?
Steven, you can start.
You want me to start, huh?
Lead it Ryan, up. You can start.
No. I got it.
So, now I want it.
Cinematography on this, I think, is my standout.
Mm-hmm. That was fantastic.
Because, there are so many shots that are just the white with something small moving through the scene, and then you have the white sky.
Mm-hmm.
That just some couple of, like him in the parking lot walking away, like the top down
shot. Oh, yeah. After the,
One of my favorite shots is whenever Steve Buscemi's character is driving his car and he goes around the parking lot of fresh snow.
Oh, yeah.
And just like, and, like making
all around in it, too. Yeah. It's like, dude, just pick a spot. There's like 80 spots up here. Pick one.
But it's such a good shot because it's just nice and static. And you get to watch them just mosey
around.
Well, and it does. Like, I love and appreciate, you know, filmmaking. Well, like, we reviewed The Holdovers in March. And, like, that was a movie that went back to a lot of, like, lock it down on a tripod style shots.
They feel very similar in a way, despite one, The Holdovers being set in an era a couple of decades like preceding this.
Yeah.
But at the same, I say that, but this is technically set in 87. So they're actually closer. Yeah.
Closer to time than you would have thought. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it does feel similar.
To be a mid-90s movie, this movie was shot not in the style of like The Rock and like a bunch of mid-90s movies.
No,
you know?
No Michael Bay here.
Can you imagine this film as like a Bayham film?
Oh, man.
Oh, no.
Nicolas Cage is just out there.
Gosh, yeah. Don't you know?
Oh, he's don't swear.
On his knees in the middle of the highway. I'd love to see Nicolas Cage try and do a Midwest
accent. That's got to be out there somewhere.
It's got to exist somewhere.
We'll get our research team on that. No, but for me, like the way it's shot, the way it's edited, feels like it could have been a movie made like in the 70s or 80s in terms of like the execution.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it got so many awards in the 90s was it was this, in the middle of all this Bayhem and like, you know, Independence Day and other stuff, you know.
Yeah, like totally bombastic action films.
Yeah, or even not even action films, just like 90s movies were lit. Like you think like the first Mission Impossible had like the, you know.
It's more stage lighting.
Yeah, and like when this came out, it's very like grounded feeling and very, like so film noir almost from that point.
A little
like
bit,
like
yeah.
20 years. It does have a little bit of a feel of film noir at times.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of shots like through Jerry Lundegaard's blinds into his office and you're just watching William H. Macy emote, you know?
Just go off.
So that was the thing I was going to say is it, like, what impressed me beyond the cinematography is just the acting, the characterizations of each of these characters and how well each actor brings them to life.
Well, the acting is phenomenal. But then the Coen brothers do such a good job at writing human stories.
Well, they're all, these people are so believable.
Yes.
And not just the small vignettes that happen alongside the main story feel just like everyday interactions that would happen.
Yeah.
With, you know, in this case, a very Midwestern flair to them.
Right. Well, the thing that I really like about Frances McDormand's character in this film is that she's, you know, very unassuming, you know, super nice, you know, person, but then like she is sharp as a wit when it comes to like figuring out clues.
Police work,
like good police work out
and
here.
And it's
one
of those things where I'm just like, this is how you write this kind of character,
right?
Yeah, and it probably helps too because I'm watching the first season of True Detective right now for the first time, and watching like both of those kind of, and I've just finished season 4 of True Detective as well.
Night Country.
And Night Country. And you get to see like, I guess the different styles of like how these people would like figure out clues and try and like talk themselves into it. And it's actually very similar.
Yeah, in some ways.
Like, it's really good.
Yeah, no, I think that's, too, you know, she kind of sets herself apart from her other law enforcement, characters in the show.
Her counterpart or whatever.
Yeah, because like, especially at the very, you know, not
at the beginning,
early, but like she's picking up on stuff that he's not.
Not to question your police work here, but.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it that early in the movie gives you the indication that like this isn't just some lady who's like
she's actually very good at her job.
Backwoods hick.
Right. Yeah. She's not just some bumbling, you know, like small town, you know, police officer. She's actually got a good mind for this kind of stuff.
Well, so this was my first time watching it because I'd never seen it before. And I, you know, going into it, I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
And it was, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It definitely had the good, like dark wit that I like from the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
But it's even a little bit more morose than a lot of their other ones.
It can get there, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially if you look morbid at times.
At the actual like things that are happening on screen, you're like, this is actually really dark. But I think the Coen brothers of all a lot of the filmmakers in Hollywood, they do those dark comedies better than most. Well,
because they write it so matter of fact, or not even matter of fact,
matter of fact is a good word. I like that.
It's just very realistic in the sense of like, this person pulled a gun on someone, and this is exactly what happens.
Someone's going to die now. Yeah.
It doesn't feel very Hollywood.
Yeah.
Well, you also don't have the prolonged shootout of like, oh, I'm diving behind garbage cans while we rip through 16 magazines and these pistols. You right. know?
Yeah. And you don't have those overly dramatic, non-realistic moments like someone talking someone out of shooting him. It's like when the gun comes out, you're getting shot probably.
That's it. Yeah,
that's pretty much it.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty likely.
So like in terms of the writing, I see why they won Best Screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
Because like when you look at the movie is kind of slower paced, like we said, but I feel like the writing is tight in that like everything that kind of sets up pays off and like all these.
It's got one sequence that I've got complaints about. We'll get into it a little later.
I think I know what it is.
Yeah.
You're incorrect. It's okay. Essential to the film.
Okay.
But yeah, there are a couple little bits here and there that they really do have a good setup and payoff like later on in the film.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh, I'm going to go check this thing out. And then just like, oh my God, we found it. You know, like,
right.
But in the sense of like, if that little miniature scene wasn't there, you know, 30 minutes prior, then you'd just be like, what is even happening here?
Oh boy, don't you know, if you've got a long road trip ahead of you, well, we've got a website for you with all the content you can listen to on the road.
All the Midwesterners are just driving off the road. Oh, right, they're
slipping in the snow.
They're finding out our addresses.
That's not how we sound, yeah? SpoilersIntendedPodcast.com, I'll get you. Oh, geez. Golly willikers.
What's on that website?
Well, we've got all of our previous episodes, along with links to things like our Discord, socials, and Patreon.
We have Discord that you can come and join. It is awesome. We have a fun little community.
It is 100% free.
It is 100% free. You get to chat. We can talk about what we're cooking, what shows we're watching that aren't what we're reviewing.
Like, or what we are reviewing.
Or what we are reviewing. Games, all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, we also have social. We have Facebook and Instagram. Follow us on both those. We post a lot of fun stuff. And if you want to see what we're going to be reviewing next, that's the best place to find out. All right, and we are back. That means we are past the spoiler wall, so it's all spoilers all the time.
If you haven't seen this over 20-year-old movie by now.
Over 20, no, almost 30.
Don't say that.
Almost 30.
I tried to be generous.
Also, we drove over the frozen lake of spoilers. Now it's spoiler territory. It's Canada.
Spoilers are. We've moved all the spoilers live in Canada.
That's a pretty far drive.
Depends on where you are.
I've driven that before. It's a pretty far drive.
In a convertible.
What?
I'll just play.
What does that have to do with anything?
Okay. The film opens. Let's get into some trivia. The film opens with the following text. This is a true story. The events depicted in this film took place in Minnesota in 1987. At the request of the survivors, the names have been changed. Out of respect for the dead, the rest has been told exactly as it occurred.
100% false.
This is a lie.
They didn't change the names at all.
That's
those
actually
jerks.
The only thing I knew about this movie was I knew because there was like some article I saw a little while ago like this is 100% false.
So if you look in the closing credits, it bears the standard fictitious persis disclaimer used by a lot of works of fiction, right? And regarding the discrepancy, the Coen brothers used to say, like when the press was going on or right after, that they based their script on an actual criminal event but wrote a fictional story around it. We weren't interested in that kind of fidelity, said Joel Coen. The basic events are the same as in the real case, but the characterizations are fully imagined. If an audience believes something's based on a real event, it gives you permission to do things they might otherwise not accept.
Mm-hmm.
Which I was like, But then, of course, fair. Later they came out and they were like, yeah.
No, it's just totally okay.
But I mean, at the same time, something like this has definitely happened.
Oh, for sure.
Maybe not in Minnesota, but the idea of...
Yeah, maybe not these exact beats, but there's
right,
definitely...
A husband paying someone to kidnap his wife so he can split the rent. Like, that's definitely happened in the last couple of decades. Maybe after Fargo.
When it came out, a lot of people were fooled, and police departments across the state of Minnesota were flooded with calls from people who had tips about the crimes that this movie was supposedly based off of.
Oh, my gosh.
That's incredible.
So, like, I thought that was a funny twist to it. It's like, which I like his point that, like, like if someone believes it's based on something true, they'll believe what happens a lot more.
It is true.
You're stretching truth, but they're like, but they said it was real, so this has to.
Right, I'll definitely say that that doesn't work as much now in the internet age.
No, but in 1996. Like
1996, definitely.
So Joel and Francis McDormand, so Joel Cohen, Francis McDormand, and John Carroll Lynch conceived backstories for their characters so they could get a feel for it. They decided that Norm and Marge, so that John Carroll Lynch is the guy that plays her husband.
Yeah.
They decided they met while working on the police force, and when they were married, they had to choose which one had to quit. And since Marge was the better officer, Norm quit and took up painting. And that's where we're at the when he's trying to enter the duck competition.
I gotta say, I love all of their interactions.
Oh, they're incredible! They're
so good,
especially again, it's the first scene we even see her in, and it's the gets the call, and he's like, "You need breakfast, Margie," and he gets up and makes her eggs. Like, it's the sweetest thing.
I'll make you eggs, and then she eats what she can, and she leaves. He just slides the plate over.
So when Carl Showalter, or Steve Buscemi's character, calls Jerry Lundegaard for the deal to be done, and he tells him 30 minutes and we'll wrap this up. From that moment, the film's running time is exactly 30 minutes.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if that was intentional or if it just happened to play out that way.
It almost has to be intentional. Yeah.
The actors used a book called How to Talk Minnesotan to help with their accents.
That's incredible.
William H. Macy stated, and this is a kind of a fun one, in an interview that despite evidence to the contrary, he hardly did any ad-libbing at all. Most of his character's stuttering mannerisms were actually written in the script the exact way he does them in the film.
Oh, interesting.
So his is all in the script or whatever. There's only one scene shot on a bright and sunny day. Cinematographer Sir Roger Deakins, by the way, hated that it was sunny, feeling that it went against the movie's mood.
Well, so now that I know it's Sir Roger Deakin, it makes more sense because, you know, 1917, Skyfall.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, he's good at what he does.
He's good at cold scenes.
Frances McDormand at the time was looking around for a role as a killer or a prostitute, and she was very hesitant to play a pregnant cop since that was kind of the opposite of what she was looking for. She goes, when I started working on it, I realized that this is one of the best gifts I've ever been given. And of course, she went on to win, you know, the Academy Award.
Yeah.
And didn't play a prostitute or a villain.
Killer.
Killer, yeah. The wood chipper used in the movie is now on display at the Fargo Moorhead Visitor Center.
that scene, that like, sequence. As she's, like, walking up and you kind of hear, like, something. And I'm like, there's only two things that this could be.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure I know what it is.
I remember the first time I saw this movie as a kid.
It was such a shock.
It was like, oh my gosh, you can do that?
All right. Ryan's like, I got all kinds of ideas now.
I got two more real quick pieces of trivia, then we'll move on. So Frances McDormand and director Joel Cohen have been married since April 1st, 1984.
Oh.
They have one child together.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was interesting. Yeah, I didn't realize they were married.
I didn't know that either.
And then the last one here, William H. Macy came up with the idea to have Jerry rehearse what he's going to say on the phone to Wade before he calls him in that scene.
So I liked that scene and that you see him rehearsing it because it's fake and it's made up, but he's trying to talk his way through it. I thought it was interesting they did not actually show us him make the call.
I love that part of it, though, because it's like...
It's a little twist, though.
What you need to know about that scene is that
he's prepping this.
You're getting a better feel for what a dirtbag he kind of is. You don't have to hear the phone call. Cause then you get so much interaction, I think, with him and Wade later at the diner. Well, he's like, they're not fooling around, Wade, you know, and like that kind of stuff that you get that dynamic that would have just been the same thing on the phone almost.
Well, they do such a good job, or he does such a good job at being like, he's not a sleazy car. Like, okay, so whenever like you see these kind of movies where like some character is in some debt or whatever and they have to do something bad to try and like recorrect the situation, most of the time like the show writers will try and make you feel bad for them, kind of like Breaking Bad or whatever.
Sure.
And
they don't make you feel bad.
They do not make you feel bad at all. He's just bad. He's just an idiot.
Yeah. The character you feel bad for at the end of this is the kid.
Oh, yeah.
Who's lost both. His one parent is dead. The other parent's in jail. And his grandfather's also dead. It's like, man, this kid's life is like ruined.
The moment, too, that they...
Hypothetically, he did get a good payout from the...
He got an inheritance. Still, that doesn't compensate.
No, it doesn't.
The moment that always drives it home about how bad Jerry Lundegaard is when Wade's little assistant guy, I can't remember his name, the money dude.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Is like, you know, how's your son? And he's like, oh gosh. it's like the moment he hadn't even think about it. Timmy or whatever his kid's name is.
Scotty.
Yeah.
He's like, oh yeah. I need to talk to that kid.
But William H. Macy is such a good actor. You could see that facial reaction to like, oh gosh, I haven't even considered. And then it shows the kid like holding the bear up to his face. And you're like, he's going to like permanently traumatize this kid. Okay, so what else spoilery stuff do we want to talk about?
I got a piece of trivia for you as well. Ooh,
hit me.
So if you watch the credits, the victim in field is credited as the artist formerly known as Prince. It's the symbol.
Oh, it's the symbol. Yeah,
but it's not. Because I saw it go by, and we were both like, wait, hold on, was Prince in this film? I don't think he was. I'm like, no, that dude was white. What the heck?
Yeah.
And so we went back. So it's the storyboard artist, J. Todd Anderson, is actually who plays the character.
Okay.
And they just put that in there as a joke, because Prince is from Minnesota.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
And that was like right after Prince had just changed
the name.
Changed the name to the artist formerly known. But he was, Prince. I mean, he's so huge then and preceding, like post that era.
Yeah.
That it's just such a funny thing to see in the credits. Like, wait, hold on. Prince wasn't in this film. I was like, wait, victim in the field. Hold on.
So, Stephen, I'm curious what scene that you felt either was not needed or
It just felt
didn't tie the movie.
Well, I want to hear if Ryan knows what it is.
Is it the scene with the old high school friend in the bar?
Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah, that is, it's according so to Frances McDormand and Joel Cohen, the most essential scene in the movie, because it gives you more insight into Marge's character than most other ones in terms of like her actual not on the cop.
Like her mentality.
Her mentality, how she approaches stuff and how like, you know, all that. So for me, I always start that scene off because this, you know, the first rewatch in like a decade. And I was like, what is this B plot? What's happening here?
Yeah, like, where are we going with this?
And then by the end of it, I was like, okay. I like that. I like getting that little nugget of like Marge.
Well, yeah, because you get to see her just be a person. And not her in the capacity of being a policeman.
But you see, in that moment, you're seeing the same person that is the police. Like, you can see the parallels to her character.
I get that in terms of like developing her as a character and stuff. It's just that scene in general, for, again, a movie that's only like an hour and 35 minutes long.
Yeah.
That scene feels like an incredible amount of time spent that doesn't really go anywhere per se for the plot itself.
It doesn't, but if you think about the fact that like Marge isn't even introduced until like 30 minutes into the movie almost, or whatever. But
she's such as soon as she's on scene, it's perfect. Like that moment when the camera pans through the bedroom and you see all the paintings, and I was like,
oh yeah,
is this Wade's bedroom? Because this is kind of a rich dude thing. I've got stuffed animals and I'm painting them. Well, and then it hit her in bed, and I was like, I don't know who that is. And she answers, and then Norm rolls over, like, I don't know who that is either. Who are these people?
That's another thing that the Coen brothers do every now and then, where you start that shot off, and it's so weird and interesting that you're like, you're on the edge of your seat of like, what is this even? Mm-hmm. What's happening?
What's happening here?
And then, you're introduced to either a new character or a new idea, and you're like, what is this? Is this another movie? You know? And then it ties in, you're like, oh, okay. The thing I wanted to talk about is the dynamic between Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare.
I was about to bring up Steve Buscemi because he honestly kind of stole the show for me.
He's
such a good actor.
He's a great actor, but then this, because he's acting against basically nothing.
Right, yeah.
Like, we paid Peter Stormare to just sit there.
Well, so it's funny,
smoke
too, because I know him from Bad Boys 2.
Right, yeah.
Oh, geez, he is. That's why he looks okay.
Yeah.
Makes more sense now.
Well, like, I think Peter Stormare had turned down the Coens earlier for, I'm trying to remember which movie it was. And so he was like ecstatic to get back.
Oh, cool.
Like, and so
he plays a great,
yeah,
just character. Whatever he is.
I love how, so watching that, like, as he's been on screen for a little bit, my wife was like, you know, that guy almost looks like Ryan Gosling if his life took a hard turn.
Just took a real bad turn. He's Ryan Gosling's uncle who's in jail.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
But specifically with him, like, you know immediately something's wrong with the blonde dude. You know what I mean? And you know Steve Buscemi's like the talker or whatever. Yeah. And then like when they get pulled over, that whole sequence, like at the very front, you know, like he's trying to like hold the $50 bill out with his wallet. Like, you know,
that's a slick little move there.
This is my registration right
here. I was
like,
I'm going to keep that in my back. I'm not going to bribe a cop. FBI, don't listen to this. But I was like impressed. Like, oh man, I see what he's getting at. He's like, what's that? He's like, it's my license and registration. Yeah. And then, yeah, Peter Stormare just grabs him and it shoots him right there. And Steve Buscemi's like, oh my gosh. And then, like, when the car passes by, again, I was trying to remember, I was like, wait, what happens? Do they track him down? And he just takes off in that car. Mm-hmm. And you're like, man, this just escalated on such a level. And it comes back later, too. I love that part with Jerry in his office when Marge comes up there and she's trying to talk to Shep Proudfoot or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then she just comes in just incidentally to talk to him about if there's any vehicles missing off the lot.
And he's like full panic mode.
He's dodging these VIN numbers from this one guy. He's like, I can't read the facts. And then you just, that just complete meltdown. But then when he realizes there's homicides involved, and it's like, this has gone beyond off the rails. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. Both those scenes always stand out to me.
I love the sequence when, like, he's dealing with the dude with the VIN numbers, and it's the shot looking into the window of his office.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He just picks up the desk board and just starts slamming it down.
Well, he has some good meltdowns.
He does.
So the Coen brothers do such a good job at writing these characters, especially, like, the father.
Oh, yeah.
Wade. Because he is...
He's so mean.
He is such a... Like, he is the exact thing that you would think of like this super rich father that doesn't like the son-in-law, but like he's given him a job.
This would be a really good deal. This would be a really good deal. Really set us up. You know, my wife and son, they'll be taken care of. Don't worry.
Oh no, yeah, he said something like, he's like, you don't ever have to worry about them being or something like that. It's whatever he says.
It makes
like
it the so most clear that at any given moment they have a will and you sure don't.
Yeah. Like they have a lifeline. You have nothing. Thing.
Yeah.
And then when he brings him into the office and, you know, he's trying to get him in on the deal and like, mm-hmm. he thinks they're going to give him the money outright. And he's like, what are you talking? We're not going to just give you money.
$700,000 or whatever.
The only thing that worked out is your finder's fee. I'm part of it. Well, you're not bringing anything to the table here, bud.
Yeah. Which on, you know, Lundegaard's part, it's like, what are you thinking, bud?
What's the thought process? Yeah.
Like, where were you going with
no
this?
No wonder you're trying to, you know, get your wife kidnapped.
Yeah.
The kidnap scene too,
it's really well done.
It's very well done.
I gotta say, man, that mm-hmm. bathroom door is more solid than any bathroom door I've ever seen.
Right? I was like, how is it taking this long?
It's got to be thick in the Midwest to keep that heat in.
In the middle of that scene, I think my wife was just like, "Our bathroom doors aren't like that." I was like, "No, I could walk through our doors. Like, nothing stopping that."
I always like just played it off as like they were just that inept at getting through the door.
Because I think Steve Buscemi's character was trying to open it.
Oh,
and like try and pry it open. Well, and then
it's not Carl. It's
hold on.
Stormare. I've totally just blanked on his name.
His name is Geir Grimsmud.
Grimsmud. Cool. He doesn't have a name. It's the Grimsmud. Unknown man. It's Ryan Gosling.
Ryan
just
Gosling
like blast the door down.
Yeah.
Because it's Steve Buscemi just flailing away with a crowbar.
Yeah. That's what I kind of thought it would be.
I can follow that interpretation too. But at the same time, like just literally, I don't care if you're Steve Buscemi size. Just go through the door.
I know. Like you can definitely shoulder that.
But I will say I did like, you know, she grabs the phone and goes into the door and she's dialing and it's just the phone just yanks out of her head. Like, wow.
Well, and then like they do that good thing with the editing where you think she's jumped out the window also. And then mm-hmm. Peter Stormare's character is like not even worried about catching
this girl.
Just
looking for a Band-Aid.
Which is like, again, just plays into how like off this guy is. Like he's not even worried about
Neospor.
Like,
he's looking for Neospor.
Yeah. And then he just looks up and that scene, when it first happened, you're like, is he looking at himself? Like, is he, you know, and then he realizes it's the curtain or whatever. And she comes, he doesn't even try to defend himself. He just like, she flops on it gets him with the curtain and then runs and falls down the stairs. You're like, man.
And then he's just sitting down there next to her and he pokes her.
Yeah. Well, it also though, it drives home the like, you know, in Jerry's mind, I wonder what he thought a kidnapping would actually look like.
Yeah.
It's definitely not this.
Just so simple. They just pick her up and, you know, a little chloroform or whatever and put her in the trunk.
But even when it starts with her, like, looking at him outside of the porch, he's, like, looking through the glass.
That incredible.
And she's not even worried about this.
No, she doesn't react to it at all.
Yeah. Until he breaks the window.
Yeah. It's just very interesting. Like, it is. But it's so well written.
Well, but it's one of those things too, when you live in not even that insulated a world, but just a world where this doesn't happen.
Yeah.
When someone walks up like that, which I can tell you now, you know, if it was me at home or my wife or If you walk up, if someone just walked up onto the deck, I'd be like, what's that dude doing up there? But if you're already wearing a ski mask,
yeah.
Which I guess in Minnesota it makes a little more.
Maybe it's actually a bit more common.
They actually wear these because it's actually cold. Oh, yeah, I guess cold.
It does make sense.
Right.
It never gets cold enough for.
Yeah, if anybody walks around in Alabama with a ski mask on, it's like there's either something wrong with him or he's up to no good or both. Both is also
probably
awesome.
Both.
Yeah.
And then like the whole like reversal too, like as they start, you know, talking about how, like, no cops, you know.
Yeah.
And then like the Wade's like, I'm taking the money. It's my money, you know. And he's like, we feel like this is the best way to go about it, Jerry. And you're like, what's going to happen now, you know?
Well, I was
Wade's
just
going to get shot.
That's I was so shocked that it was just Wade. I thought Wade was going to walk up to the car and his buddy was going to be there and that was going to be the blow up was, well, there's two people.
Right.
Yeah. And then no, it's just Wade, just, you know, one man armying this, and he's not an army.
Well, and then, you know, Steve Buscemi ends up getting shot, like, in the face, in the cheek or whatever, and then just has to deal with that the rest of the movie.
Yep.
And then you get to see, like, kind of a parallel to, like, when he's at the airport. That's the scene we were talking about earlier where they're the parking. Like
driving around.
Parking, yeah. When he leaves, and that guy's like, $4. And he's like, I just pulled in here, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, $4. And then at the end, after he shoots him, and you see the or whatever you want to call that guy, the
toll booth attendant,
whoever is shot dead. And you're like, oh my gosh, this guy does not have a good track record with toll booth boys.
Yeah.
No, he does not.
But yeah, that whole scene where Wade rolls up, the way it plays out, the rhythm of it, I always love. And then when Jerry Lundegaard comes up at the end and you're like, what's he going to do?
And you just see the trunk open.
Yep. Yeah. And you're like, what do you mean?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I saw it too. He rolls up and the car just sits in the trunk. I was like, oh, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah. Well, it just shows how much of his character is just like, this is the road I'm on.
Right.
And I have to do this because the only thing that matters to me is not getting caught.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, it has nothing to do with any of it, like his wife, his kid, or anything like that.
No.
And it just shows how much of a dirtbag he is.
Yeah. How selfish he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I think that it also plays out through the ending when you see they catch him in the motel and you're just like, of course, this is where this guy would do a terrible job of escaping. He would, like, you know, not hide his identity good enough. And like, here he is.
Yep.
Yeah. And then, so when Steve Buscemi comes back to the cabin, and then all that stuff has happened with
Gene.
Gare, however you say
whatever his name is.
Yeah.
Gene and
Ryan Gosling's uncle.
Ryan Gosling's uncle. Peter Stormare.
Blonde boy.
And he's clear, like, she's dead.
Yeah.
You know, Steve Buscemi shot, he's hidden the money, you know, in the snow or whatever. And then, like, all that happens and it
cuts
away. That's
going to be a very happy farmer one day.
Yeah, one day.
As soon as this thaws out, like, somebody's going to be like, what's that?
It's summer, that farmer's going to be like, what's this thing? Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
$1 million.
But, yeah, all that, you know, leads to the climax of the wood chipper.
Yeah.
And just that whole scene, like, you know, she's driving around and it's the bar owner, right? Is he the one that tips him off to The guy was in here.
Because he mentions the lake.
The lake.
And she goes out and drives around the lake.
She's just tooling around, following the hunt.
She's just doing good police work.
There's the Sierra.
Yeah.
Well, I like how, too, when she's talking over the radio, and, like, you can hear the other, whoever she's talking to, dispatch, whatever, on the other side, is like, well, sit tight, let me get more cops there. If she just pulls the gun and goes.
Nope.
She doesn't even pull the gun until she, like, sees him, basically. And it's like, man, this is so opposite to how, like, a police drama unfolds nowadays, where it's like, as soon as they step out of the car, gun drawn. Like, she pulled her, like, 38 or whatever out, and my wife was like, that's her gun?
Right. I mean, they're in the Midwest. Like, what do you expect?
Well, it's also, it's set in the 80s. Like, this is
what they did.
Revolver issue for a police officer back then.
Yeah, because they didn't, most of, like, they didn't really move to, like, actual magazined guns.
Especially for, like, a detective or anything like that. Yeah. Because, I mean, I guess at some point they had the realization, hey, you know, if you're in a shootout and you only get 6 shots, if we could get that to, like, I don't know, 25, it'd be a lot better.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. But, I think it speaks to that time of, like, small town.
I do love how the second that he realizes that she's there pointing the gun at him, he doesn't even try to, like, attack her. He just runs.
Oh, no, he throws the log at her.
Well, like, but then he's gone. That basically doesn't count.
Yeah.
Like,
it's just a distraction.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's just out on that ice behind him taking those shots. Yeah, so good. All right, well, I think we've already covered this a little bit, but let's go on real quick. Would you rewatch it?
I would definitely rewatch it, but not anytime soon.
Right. This isn't a movie that's like put it on whenever.
Yeah,
this
no, is definitely a, not.
Got to be in the mood for it kind of type thing.
I feel like this has ended up kind of like right now, let's say in my life, I'm in a rewatch Coen Brothers films over a certain period of time. This is now at the bottom of the list. and that speed of my rewatch is going to be stretched out over so many years that it's going to be a decade.
Right. Yeah.
It'll get rewatched. It's just not anytime soon.
Yeah, because like I'll say like a movie like Burn After Reading is much easier for me to rewatch. Or, just kind of whenever. Oh, yeah.
Or Big Lebowski, yeah. Oh Brother Where Art Thou. Well, those are really easy to just put on.
Oh Brother Where Art Thou, Big Lebowski, and Raising Arizona have like the same energy on mm-hmm. some level. And Burn After Reading.
Yeah.
Like the same
I can see it.
Almost madcap comedy
yeah.
energy to
right.
them.
Which is what you're almost looking for in Fargo, but it's so much more bleak.
It's very, yeah, yeah. And yeah. so Fargo feels more like No Country for Old Men to
yes.
me.
Yes.
It, like, yeah, it, very it's much.
Got the police procedural drama style, mm-hmm. you know, storytelling. Things are serious. There's some like dry humor mm-hmm. here and there, but mm-hmm. it's like, it's a very, you know, and it's a very well written and yeah. unfolds in an interesting way.
It's a very subdued film.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, yeah, Fargo. Like, I do want to mention really quick the music, because we kind of touched it a little bit and we played some in the act. Mm-hmm. Like, I love a lot of the
music's
scenes.
Actually really good.
Yeah. It fits so well.
Yeah, it just kind of exists, and it's not like, you know, a score that I'm going to like put on a playlist, but it's not like it's good.
But it fits the vibe.
I feel like some of these songs could very easily slide into a playlist. And you know, over the course of you may not be like, oh, it's definitely Fargo. But if it's playing, you'd just be like, oh, yeah, this is a mood. You
know? So I think between the writing from the Coens, the acting from, you know, Francis and William H. Macy and everybody.
Our principal characters.
Roger Deakins' cinematography and the music. I think this movie, there's a reason this was nominated for so many.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely.
For sure. I think the cinematography really pushes it for me, because there are so many well-constructed scenes where it's just that flat line through the middle and you move your object through it. And it's really basic stuff when you think about it, but you just don't see it very often.
Well, there's a scene towards the end, close to the credits, where it's just white and you don't know what you're even looking at until the car starts to come over the hill and you're like, oh,
with the lights on. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the scene, like, it's almost like it melts into, you know, being or whatever. And
and that's also
obviously
how
being shot
film,
on film. It just looks, you know, great.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how the film opens too, with the car going down the road with the bird on the, and you're like, I don't really know what I'm observing here. Like, okay. He's got a car on a trailer. Where are we? What is going on?
Yeah.
It's almost the same energy as the open.
All right, well, before we wrap things up, let's talk a little bit about our Patreon.
For $1, just $1, one measly dollar, you can gain access to all of our bonus content, Patreon picks polls where you get to vote on something that we are going to review. You get early access to it. Mm-hmm. We have tons of content that you can access for just $1. It's the best way to support the show.
All kinds of wild, wacky, zany things going on. You want to talk about different energy, right?
Like
we have some energy in these, but the bonus episodes, those are their own kind of energy.
That's like the madcap energy.
That is the Burn After Reading, full-on Brad Pitt gym instructor going on in some of those.
Yeah. We have a lot of fun on those.
Yeah. Dealing with ChatGPT, U.S. presidents, all sorts of fun stuff.
Taste testing stuff until we make ourselves sick.
I watched a video the other day of an internet channel. They tried like 80 different chips in one video.
No.
And I was like, we did like
we've been
30, and I
we've
felt
been
like I was going to barf.
Terrible,
I don't know how they need a lot of Pepto.
Or they take a lot of time filming it. Ooh.
All right, well, that sounds about like all the time we have. So as always, follow us on social, leave us a review wherever you're listening now, and share us with a friend. Until next time, I'm Ryan.
I'm Andrew.
And I'm Steven.
And every spoiler was intended.
Don't you know?